Welcome or welcome back to Horse for Whore. I'm Mariah.
And I'm Kayla.
And this week is going to be a little bit of a palate cleanser because we have been doing some whorish cases.
So true. So for those of you who've come for the horrendous cases that we've been doing, please stick around.
There'll be another one. Don't worry. But I just need like a tiny break. And this one is still bad, still illegal stuff, but not as intense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Kayla, you don't even know what it is. So let's just get into it. On the morning of December 2nd, 2020, Tim Brown woke up early to start a fire in his fireplace. The night before, an unseasonable cold front had descended upon Love's Landing in Florida, where Tim lived with his wife, Duck.
That is an adorable name for a town.
Love's Landing, yes.
A lady.
Yes.
Duck.
Also, she's of Vietnamese descent, and I had to use the Google pronunciation because I don't want it to be like Deuce or something like that. But it says Duck, so if that's wrong, I'm very sorry. But we're going to say
Duck.
Oh,
okay. I thought it was a nickname, but that's cute. Yeah.
At the bottom of the cul-de-sac where the couple lived, a thin layer of frost covered the long grass runways that wrapped through the quiet neighborhood. The area was known as a hideaway for those in the aviation community, with many members being pilots, plane engineers, or general flying enthusiasts.
So that makes sense why they referred to it as a runway. I was like, why?
And nearly everyone in Love's Landing owned a plane, and of course, Tim and Duck were no exception.
What the fuck?
Yeah, I know. I'm like, I can't even imagine this place.
Yeah.
A carpenter by trade, Tim had spent much of his life enjoying the outdoors. In his younger days, he was an expert scuba diver and deep sea fisherman, but now, at 66, his age had caught up with him. Health hospitals in recent years, including two heart attacks, had kept him in and out of the hospital, and flying offered the chance for Tim to, quote, continue the fun. Soon after moving to Love's Landing in 2017, the couple quickly became one of the best-liked couples in the air park, according to all of their neighbors. So they were just a cool, you know, the party house kind of neighbors that you want.
At 66?
Get some of those STDs. No, I'm just kidding. Oh. We have no That's indication funny. Of that. Tim had just raised the hangar door when an unmarked Dodge Durango roared into the driveway along with a Marion County police cruiser. As he turned around towards the commotion, a law enforcement agent leaped out of the SUV, pointed his barrel of the rifle at Tim, and shouted, "Stop, raise your hands."
Do you want me to stop or do you want me to raise my hands?
Yeah, confusing. Tim did as he was told, and soon officers from half a dozen federal agencies were fanning out across the property. The lead agent approached him and said, "Are you Tim Brown?" And Tim just nodded. Agents cleared the hangar and headed towards the main house to execute a search warrant, and Love Landing's neighbors were confused as heck.
Yeah, I would be too.
Yeah, no one knew what Tim had done, and they all kind of assumed at first that it was a mistake.
Okay.
They recalled, how could Tim Brown, a man who seemed like a typical Florida retiree who loved doting on his wife, fishing with friends, and flying his plane, do something so horrible that warranted all the chaos?
What part of any of the story is normal? Instead of opening his garage door, he's opening a hangar door.
Yeah, they love their hobby. But the Love Landing neighborhood quickly found out that Tim Brown was not who he said he was, and his entire life was built on a secret. This is the story of Howard Farley Jr., also known as Tim Brown, the alleged leader of one of the largest drug rings in Nebraska history. All right.
Never heard of this.
I know.
But also, since this is going the opposite way that it usually goes, where the police are correct, here's another palate cleanser for you really quickly. I got off the interstate yesterday to get gas, and right before the exit, there was a car in, like, the median part, and it looked like it was broken down or something, and two state police officers were behind it with their lights on, but when I passed, nobody was in the car. So I go get off the exit, the next exit, and there was an African-American man walking on the side of the shoulder, and I didn't think anything of it. Well, the state police comes up behind, blocks part of the lane with his lights on, and just, like, gets out of the car and starts talking to this guy. And I'm like, what the fuck are you about to do?
Yeah, like, what the fuck is happening? So I watch it
at the gas station that's, like, right there. This dude was actually, I'm pretty sure, from what it looked like, was very nice to this guy. Put him in the cruiser, no handcuffs, nothing, and took him wherever he needed to go. I guess the guy ran out of gas or it broke down or something. Literally took him where he needed to go. I'm pretty sure this cop helped a citizen.
Oh my God. A white cop
helped a black citizen.
That's awesome.
And I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's what happened. So I'm very pleased about that interaction.
Yeah. I like to think that's how, like, most interactions go. And then we see, like, obviously the loud extreme events, but yeah, sadly I don't think that's true. So that's a very nice interaction.
Yeah, I agree. Which is why I was watching it. I was like, fuck, am I going to have to, like, start recording or, like,
yeah,
what the fuck am I going to do?
Or just, you know,
and then,
yeah,
it seemed,
let them know that there's like an audience. Interaction.
So as much as we shit on the cops and, you know.
There's good ones out there. One bad apple spoils the bunch, you know.
Yeah. So that was a nice little interaction. So,
hell yeah.
Here's your positivity for the week, guys.
Born in 1948 as the fourth of five kids, Howard Farley Jr., who we will just call Farley, spent his childhood in Lincoln, Nebraska. The son of a blue-collared worker, Farley demonstrated a knack for mechanics from a young age. He built award-winning model cars and a playhouse for his hamsters dubbed the Sugar Shack.
I love that.
Me too. That's cute. Later in life, he crafted an RV out of an old school bus, which that is very on trend in today's society, Farley.
That would be so cool.
He was described as handsome and popular in school, but at home, it was a little more complicated. When he was in his early teens, his mother abandoned the family, and Farley's father was stuck with a house full of kids that, by all accounts, he didn't necessarily want.
Good. I love that for the kids.
His elder sister, Beverly, later recounted that their mother leaving affected all of them, but especially Farley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's like one of the youngest.
Eventually, Farley fell in with a little bit of a rebellious crowd. He later stated, quote, "My friends were more the fun-loving guys that rode motorcycles to school, dated the cheerleaders, and had keg parties on the weekends," end quote.
I mean, that sounds pretty, like, on par.
Yeah, especially for the 60s.
Yeah, that's just someone with, like, a lack of parental supervision. Or, like, parents that just don't care that you go to parties.
In September of 1965, Farley experienced his first brush with the law. Like most teens of the time, he enjoyed cars and cruising around, and he would often find himself illegally street racing. So one night, the police busted a street race, and Farley attempted to flee, driving at nearly 100 miles an hour. He actually had a date in a car, and in all of the chase and the chaos, the police actually fired weapons on his car and hit the girl in the jaw.
What the fuck?
Eventually, Farley did stop the vehicle, and he was arrested and sentenced to a year of probation Fortunately, his date survived, and she later sued Farley for $25,000.
Yeah, she should probably sue the police, too.
Yeah, and he was just 16 years old.
That's fucked up.
Mm-hmm. However, luckily, Farley was able to get his act together enough to capitalize on his mechanical skills, and eventually he was hired full-time at the Burlington Northern Rail Yards.
Okay.
So back in those days, back in my day, the railroad, like working on the railroad, paid really well. I mean, God, it still does.
Yeah, because there was a lot of dangerous-ass shit.
Yeah.
I mean, there still is, but there's more safety measures.
Oh, yeah. And the union.
Yeah, that's true.
And engineers earned a salary during the time of $30,000, which translates to over $290,000 today. So,
damn.
He's making fucking money.
Damn, that's nice.
Yeah. Eventually, Farley married and had a child with his high school sweetheart, Christine, and the couple named their daughter Amy. However, while Christine blossomed into an adult who took responsibility, paid her bills, and stayed home with the baby, Farley decided to take up partying and skydiving.
This dude is an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah. In 1969, he and another man were arrested for attempting to rob a local carpeting business.
What were you trying to get?
I know, yeah. How much money do fucking, like, the carpet business make, my guy? Like,
I mean, maybe back then a lot.
That's crazy.
Carpeting is expensive.
But I doubt they keep it on hand, you know? Like, it's probably all in merchandise and labor, I imagine.
I mean, unless they're just stealing carpets.
Yeah. Eventually, Farley took a job with a railroad company in Alaska, just leaving behind his wife and daughter. And, so the next year, obviously, he and Christine filed for divorce and separated.
Did they have a conversation? You probably don't know, but, like, did he just up and go, or did they have a conversation, or, like...
Okay, from the sources, it made it sound like he just left and was like,
just
I'm
disappeared.
Fucking done. Yeah. And then she was like, I guess we should probably file for divorce at this point, right? But I could be wrong, obviously. Yeah.
She should have waited, and then, like, she should have waited the 10 years, and then, like, declared him, or is it 10 years? It's not 10 years to declare them dead, is it?
Isn't it like 7? It's a very strange amount, I thought. Who knows?
Yeah.
She should have filed like abandonment or something. There should be some filing under abandonment. I have no idea. I've never been married, so I obviously lack knowledge.
I've never looked into it, so
thank God I've never been divorced either, so I don't know what you can choose.
I think it's just contested or uncontested.
Yeah, right?
I'm sure. Well, that's for divorce, but, like, abandonment would be different. It would be a different set of paperwork.
Oh, there is paperwork for abandonment?
Most definitely. You know, especially back in the 60s. Abandonment as grounds for divorce.
Oh.
Well, I guess it depends on the state, but in Illinois, it's a no-fault divorce state, so you can... You do not have to prove abandonment to file for divorce.
That's good. I like that. You should be able to just file for divorce.
Oh, okay. That's probably what she did, because abandonment, to file for that, it's usually a year gone.
Oh, okay. So let's hope that Christine filed for that. And I hope she took or at least half that man's pennies.
And you can file for physical absence, emotional withdrawal, neglecting financial responsibilities, or substance abuse. Those are the four types of marital abandonment.
Huh. Or substance abuse.
The more you know.
I pray that no one listening to this ever has to file, but now you know.
I know. But also back then, like, she was a stay-at-home mom, right? So, like, hello. How are you just going to leave?
And she couldn't have a credit card because women weren't allowed to have credit cards till like the fucking 80s. And this is the 60s, so.
That's fucked up.
Yeah, dude. It's literally fucked up. Yep.
Actually, that's really insane. You think it's at least a couple generations back.
Yeah, people like to act like, oh, this whole feminism thing, like that was so long ago. No, literally in the
It really
80s.
wasn't.
And then, like, it was just recently where women were able to file for divorce when no-fault divorce was even a thing. So,
Did I do the math right? That's only like 40 years.
yeah.
Is that right? The 80s?
Yeah.
That's so.
It blows your mind when you think about it because it feels like the 90s
I
were
am
yesterday.
31. I'm 31.
Yeah.
So, are we
Think a
serious?
feminist. Think a feminist.
I knew it wasn't like that long ago, but I thought it was at least double that time.
No. It's terrible.
Dude.
We hate everything, but day by day, step by step, change is happening. It's
It's getting
yep.
there.
So over the next 15 years, Farley divided his time between Alaska, Washington, and Florida, where he lived when he wasn't working the rails. He married again, but that marriage resulted in divorce, and occasionally family drama drew him back to Nebraska, but he never stayed long.
I just don't understand. Like, why are you? You know what? I'm not rich, so I wouldn't
Yeah.
know. Never mind.
He's a Rolling Stone. By the 1980s, Farley had quit the railroad business and relocated to Lake Worth, Florida, a beach town about 60 miles north of Miami.
Yeah, he probably has a fuck ton of money.
Yeah, but he was struggling with figuring out what to do next, and eventually he was introduced to the drug trade, and it's not exactly clear.
Well, he was probably using and then.
Well, so according to the sources, he'd never used, what's the
Oh,
saying?
really?
Yeah, you don't use your own stash or whatever. So allegedly, he wasn't. An unidentified associate allegedly told Farley that as someone who traveled as frequently as he did, he could make a fortune, and all he had to do was bring drugs with him on his trips.
Is that
That's
it?
it.
Is that how I
Yeah.
become rich? I'm
Yep, get rich quick.
not saying hit me up, but like, no, I'm just kidding.
No,
I would never.
fuck
I think I would be
no.
way too fucking
Jesus
paranoid,
Christ,
and I
yeah.
can't lie for shit. So like, I would just be. I mean, I guess it's different if you have your own airplane and shit.
But I'm just naturally a stressed out person, so I know that if I had anything, I'm like One time I took a lighter through TSA. Didn't know that they were allowed, and I was like, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God. And no, they're fucking allowed.
Dude, TSA stresses me out. I freak out whenever like I have any kind of liquids. Just even though like the stuff that's allowed, it'll be correctly in the baggie and everything else. And I have pre-check, so like I don't even have to do that. I'm just freaking out because TSA just acts like they're, I don't
They can
know, they
send you
act
to
like they do
prison at any
something.
moment. That's what it feels like.
Yeah,
Like any
I don't want
moment, a
my
cop is
butt
gonna
searched, you know?
come here, put he I'm gonna be handcuffed and be taken away and never see my family. Like that's what TSA feels
They're just
like.
so like drill
Yes.
instructor.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, there's no reason to be like that.
I agree.
You yelling at me is not gonna get me to comprehend what you're saying.
Yeah, if anything, I'm just like, why are you yelling at me? I'm an adult and you're an
Like,
adult. That's all
yeah,
I
it's like a
think.
freeze mode.
Yeah. Yes.
Like I'll freeze and be like, what have I done? Hello. You have to be gentle.
So Farley told Tyrone Baskin, a close high school friend, that he'd saved $30,000 and he was going to, quote, go for it.
Go for it.
Farley was going to invest the money in a shipment of cocaine and flip it for big bucks.
I call that an investment also.
Jesus. And there is no better place than Florida to put his new plan into action, as it was the height of the Miami Vice era drug boom, and Farley had little trouble finding a supplier. Miami. That's what I always think. That's all I can think. Miami. Also, have you watched, oh my God, I'm gonna get it wrong, but I think it's called Griselda on Netflix with Sofia Vergara.
Oh no,
It's
but I
good.
want to see it. I saw her in like character and I was like, she looks so familiar. And then I looked it up and I'm like, that is not Sophia. But it is. She did really well.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was her at
Yeah.
first because I love Modern Family. I've seen every single episode. I fucking love that show. And I was sitting there like, I know her. And then I finally looked it up. It is such a good series. Highly recommend.
It looked really good, so I will probably watch it at some point.
Yeah, worth it. And also, it relates back to this. Ah! So Farley started ferrying drugs to contacts in Nebraska and Alaska. In the beginning, it was a largely insular affair. He mostly supplied former co-workers and friends. And sometimes Farley even asked his friends to mail packages of cocaine using FedEx.
Did they know it was cocaine?
Yeah, probably. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
At least twice, Farley drove from Florida to Alaska and back again, stopping in Lincoln, Nebraska along the way. Tyrone later stated,
Oh, you said Nebraska, and I'm thinking Alaska.
oh, no, he did. He went from Florida to Alaska, but stopped in Nebraska.
Oh, I guess you can ferry. Yeah. Okay. I was sitting here going, how the fuck do you drive? Nope. Got it. My brain is not working
Wow.
today.
Before long, Farley was laying over in Lincoln with larger and larger amounts of drugs. At the time, it was the tail end of the disco era and the demand was high, but Farley didn't
Oh, I
like dealing
bet.
grams to strangers.
Yeah.
Instead, he built out a distribution network among friends and family, people that he could trust. His sister Mary and her husband Gary, Mary and Gary,
Mary and Gary.
last names Machado, got involved. According to prosecutors, Farley used their house in Lincoln, Nebraska for storage and sales. And high school friends also joined in. Tyrone Baskin from earlier, Robert Frame, and John Kaler, all of people in the school, and all Vietnam veterans with various degrees of addiction started dealing drugs for Farley.
Interesting.
Farley taught them how to cut the high-grade coke he brought from Florida with a type of sugar to increase the volume and make more money selling it. And he gave his friends a cut, or I'm sorry, he collected his cut of the sales whenever he was in Lincoln, Nebraska. So he truly trusted these people and ran it, not being in Nebraska.
And they like didn't rip him off, like
Yeah.
they're getting the money and he's trusting them with his portion of it too. And he's just like, oh yeah, I'll just pick it up later. And they're like, yeah, cool. Those are some pretty good friends.
But Farley wasn't the only person supplying drugs in Lincoln. Coke dealing had become a cottage industry among hard-partying railroaders. A man named Clyde Meyer, who was also a Burlington Northern engineer, ran an operation out of his house. And like Farley, Clyde Meyer had started small, but unlike Farley, whose cocaine was supplied from Southern America, Meyer's coke came from Colorado, but obviously users didn't care about a product's origin once it hit the street. However, those of us who have watched Griselda, we know that the coke from South America is better quality than the coke that was
Yeah.
available here.
I was about to say, why wouldn't they care?
The way, I mean, even the show and Narcos, like everything that you read about it, like it's portrayed as this high grade shit.
Yeah. I mean, probably not after he cut it with sugar,
Yeah.
but
But also, I'm
at
sure they're
least
just
cutting it
like,
with sugar instead of
they're like, I
fentanyl.
need my coke. Like, give it to me.
Yeah, I guess they don't care.
By 1984, Farley's efforts had paid off. An acquaintance remembered going to Farley's mother's house and seeing bricks of cocaine piled to the ceiling in closets.
I just imagine like a Coke
That's
sofa.
it's fucking insane. The person claimed that Farley was, quote, definitely worth more than seven figures at that time, easily.
Jesus.
Another friend remembered Farley stashing wads of cash in safety deposit boxes across southern Florida, and court records have him making massive bank deposits ranging from $80,000 to $100,000 at a time.
Can I have a little
I
bit?
know, I'm like, I see why people get in the drug trade. Like, that's
Yeah.
tempting, you know? But
Yeah,
I
like you could
couldn't.
have everything paid off.
I'm, like we said,
Yeah,
I am so
I totally
nervous.
agree. I
Yeah.
know, I totally agree, but like, can you imagine having everything paid off?
Yeah, crazy.
That would be so nice.
Farley was still in his early 30s and he'd found a quick way to fund the adventurous life that he'd always dreamed of, and he'd done it on his own terms. Which,
A real entrepreneur, I would say.
girl boss. He wasn't flashy or aggressive. In fact, most acquaintances said that he took a generally relaxed approach to the drug trade, and he never needed to threaten people with violence, nor was he ever physically violent. Which, I mean, you're kind of the like kingpin, so I feel like you probably don't need to be violent, but whatever. In Florida, Farley took up water sports and turned out to be a talented diver, which we talked about earlier. He partied hard at a bar known as Harry's Banana Farm in Lake Worth.
I'd go there.
I know, me too. Harry's Banana Farm. I hope everyone wears like those banana hammock swimsuits or
And they
whatever.
only serve banana daiquiris. That'd be interesting. That'd be funny.
Farley also talked about going legit and, you know, quitting the whole drug trade. He wanted to buy a boat and start a business chartering passengers from Florida into the Caribbean.
That's cool. You could probably make some money doing that.
Yeah. But also, Farley began planning for a different kind of future. In 1982, he filed an application for a social security number under the name Timothy Terry Brown, a 3-month-old child who died after a short illness in January 1955. We don't know if Farley sensed that there was trouble ahead or if he was just being cautious, but either way, he was aware of the risk that he was taking. I mean, in just a few years, he'd become one of Lincoln, Nebraska's major drug suppliers, and it was only a matter of time before law enforcement took notice. And eventually they did.
Yeah, that's pretty smart, though.
Yeah. On August 31st, 1983, officers from the house of a rail, or I'm sorry, officers raided the house of a railroader named Juan Varga Manchego and discovered 3/4 of a pound of cocaine. And his arrest set off a chain reaction. He actually worked with undercover officers and started naming names. Tips from Crime Stoppers called in and were folded into the investigation. Wiretaps were ordered for the homes of the friends and Farley's sister and brother-in-law. And before long, law enforcement fleshed out the framework of what they believed to be a sprawling criminal conspiracy.
I just want to point out, and I'm not intending to sow discourse here amongst anybody, but like, if that guy had never said a word, can you imagine
That's why you gotta keep your mouth
like how
shut.
long it would have?
Always, though.
Don't say anything. But he probably talked because he was totally gonna get screwed.
Fuck yeah, a low man on the totem pole. Yeah, you're about to get fucked, bro. You're an example will be made out of you.
Yeah, and like, so you trust all these people, but like, if you're not training them how to be smart, like this guy obviously is, they're gonna get caught and they don't wanna go to prison.
Fuck no, I don't either. If someone caught me, I'd squeal like a pig so fast. I'd be like, but yes,
Put
Tim
me in witness
Brown.
protection.
Yeah. But as far as investigators were concerned, this investigation couldn't have come at a better time. Money was pouring into federal prosecutors' offices as President Ronald Reagan ramped up the war on drugs. Yep, in the summer of 1984, Nebraska officials tapped into the budgetary flow by working with federal agencies on the new cocaine trafficking investigation, and they actually dubbed it Operation Southern Line because they knew that most of the drugs in Lincoln, Nebraska came from Florida and most likely from South America by then. They also knew that many of the criminal conspiracy's main players were current or former railroaders who were taking advantage of their job, which allowed them to travel the nation.
That's pretty interesting that they had that information, though.
Well, Juan spilled.
Well, did they have that before he spilled or after?
I think that was after he spilled. So they got all that from him,
That's not impressive at all.
Running the investigation, Kayla, not impressed. She said,
I thought it was impressive police work. I was like, damn, they had a lot of info, actually. And then they found this guy, like, okay, but they could have found that information off of just watching Juan.
Yeah, and seeing who he was selling to, all of that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so it could still be, you know.
Juan just confirmed it and said, yeah, bro.
Yeah, yeah, let's go with that. We're being really lenient and positive today. So yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot of information you found.
Good job.
All on your own.
So running the investigation was a man named Dwayne Bullock, who was the head of the Lincoln-Lancaster County Narcotics Unit, and Bruce Gillian, a Lancaster County prosecutor. Interestingly, Gillian and Farley had actually gone to the same high school, but they definitely ran with different crowds.
Yeah.
While Farley rode a motorcycle and dated popular girls, Gillian was president of the chess club and described as a by-the-book kind of guy. So neither Bullock nor Gillian were under the impression that the alleged network of traffickers amounted to a sophisticated cartel operation. Rather, it was a loose-knit, blue-collar affair, but there was still a hierarchy. In meetings with the DEA, the two investigators create an organizational flowchart with the names of more than 24 co-conspirators. And at the very, very top was Farley. According to prosecutors, he even had a nickname, and he was called the Big H. Howard.
For Howard?
Yeah. Hey, Howard.
Wow, Howard. That's such a cool name.
In the fall of 1985, authorities unsealed a sprawling series of indictments that named 74 people across five states in a massive drug-busting operation.
That prosecutor did not know what he was walking into, and that probably made his career.
Yep. According to the Lincoln Journal-Star, Operation Southern Line was the largest drug case ever in Nebraska history. On the morning of October 24th, 1985, agents and officers from the police, the FBI, the sheriff's office, the IRS, the DEA, and Nebraska State Patrol spread out across Lincoln like an occupying force. One by one, Operation Southern Line defendants were rounded up and taken to the federal courthouse, many of them before the night was even over. By the time authorities were finished, more than 50 people had been arrested, and news of the bust splashed across the front pages of local papers. Reports claimed that over $600,000 worth of drugs had been confiscated, and Bullock told reporters, quote, many of those arrested were major drug dealers, and that the operation could have major impact on drug sources in Lincoln for years to come. It was the kind of case that made careers, and Gillian was promoted to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Did he do anything else cool with his, like, time?
Gillian?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He hunted Farley.
I mean, after this case.
Oh, I have no idea. I hope. Yeah, well, I have never heard of him, so I hope he...
Yeah, right?
But there was one problem. Among the handful of targets not arrested was the name at the top of the flowchart, Howard Farley Jr.
How did the news break and they not have him under arrest yet and he still
That's the question. How the fuck did they unseal the indictments without capturing the main guy?
Yeah.
Also, importantly, Farley was the first person in Nebraska to be charged under what is known as 848, a federal statute reserved for prosecuting drug traffickers who operate a, quote, continuing criminal enterprise, also referred to as the Kingpin statute, and prosecutors used it against El Chapo.
Oh, okay.
So Farley was gone. And that was a major problem.
In the wind.
Yep. And other cracks in the Operation Southern Line began to widen. DEA agents claimed to have tracked Farley moving multiple pounds of cocaine across state lines, but the indictment revealed that the prosecutors only had enough hard evidence to attribute Farley to 8 ounces. Moreover, defense attorneys told reporters that defendants weren't involved in the drug trade at all, but rather many of them were users buying for themselves or just a few close friends. Many of these individuals eventually ended up being charged with multiple felonies and faced years in prison for what amounted to low-level street buys. And in the end, only 8 defendants did any time. The rest were sentenced to probation or their cases were dropped altogether. And while Operation Southern Line may have made careers, it did little to disrupt Lincoln's drug trade. And Farley remained a mystery. Without cell phones or GPS, law enforcement were forced to rely largely on human intelligence to draw Farley out.
Snitches.
Yeah, and nearly all of his co-conspirators were willing to cooperate in exchange for reduced sentences, but none mm-hmm. could tell them where he went.
Yeah, because he's not going to tell them.
Fuck no.
Why would he tell them?
Yeah, he's keeping his mouth shut. Over time, Farley took on kind of a mythic quality among the people he left behind, with some calling him the D.B. Cooper of Nebraska, and he also became known as a white whale. So, you know, the uncatchable.
Oh, okay. It's like, why white whale?
Yeah.
No, that makes sense.
So quickly after Operation Southern Line busted all of his conspirators, Farley reemerged as Tim Brown, a 31-year-old Florida native with a pocket full of legitimate government documents.
How old was he at the time that he emerged as Tim?
31.
Okay, yeah. So he actually did do his regular. Okay.
A year after the arrest, he was spotted by a DEA informant on the island of St. Martin, which is about 160 miles east of Puerto Rico. In addition to excellent fishing and diving, the Caribbean is also known as being a haven for fugitives. Which, no shade, but people's papers are rarely checked and ports are essentially lawless.
Yeah, but, like, you work on, like, Caribbean time or island time.
Yeah, yeah, and so it's relaxed, you know, so kind of, like...
People just don't care. They just go about their business.
Bill Ware, a sailor who met Farley, as the name Tim Brown, in 1986, stated that he made good of his dream on buying a boat because he traveled freely between all of the islands on a 55-foot catamaran called the Deja Vu.
Is that a yacht?
Yeah. Well, I mean, not a yacht, but it's like a little mini boat. You can live on them.
Oh.
Yeah, catamaran. Yeah, people live on them.
Oh. Ooh, that's nice.
Yeah. 55 feet. Yeah, that's a big one, too.
Yeah. These look nice.
Uh-huh. Within a few years, Farley returned to the southern Florida coast, this time with Duck, who he had met in St. Martin while she was vacationing there in 1985.
Oh, so she's rich, too.
And, okay, so she was described as whip smart and ambitious, and she was one of the few people who would have been likely to meet a background more dramatic than his own. So Duck and her family actually fled Vietnam after the fall of Saigon in 1975, and their harrowing journey here included floating at sea for 2 days with no supplies before being rescued by the U.S. Navy. They then spent months in a refugee camp before Duck's family was eventually resettled in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where she learned English, excelled in school, and graduated from college.
Wow, that's really nice.
Yeah. On June 1st, 1993, Duck and Farley were married by a deputy clerk at the Broward County Courthouse in Fort Lauderdale. At one point, Farley's mother and his sister Beverly risked a visit to the newlyweds, and they actually referred to Farley by his alias Tim Brown. However, that was the last time they ever saw him.
Oh.
So not much is known in between this time, but in 2017, Farley began having health issues, which caused him and Duck to downsize and move to Love's Landing, and by then, he discovered his love for aviation.
Yeah, downsize.
Yeah, downsize to a plane from a 55-foot catamaran. No.
In a subdivision where everyone has their own hangar, and actually has their own runway, which is why the grass is referred to as a runway, because it actually is a runway.
So following his arrest in Florida, when investigators talked to his neighbors, none had even the vaguest sense that Farley wasn't who he said he was. Many described him as genuine and kind-hearted, with small gestures of friendship becoming his hallmark. Year after year, he collected buckets of stray golf balls that landed on his property, and he gave them to his friend, who was an avid golfer.
It's not hard to do things like that. It's like very easy.
It's easy to be nice, yeah. After a fishing buddy's wife was diagnosed with cancer, Farley appeared on their doorstep with trays of food and spent his evenings at their house helping their young daughter with her homework.
That's so nice.
He doted on his mother-in-law after the death of her husband and regularly picked up trash along the main road and within his neighborhood.
He was just living his life.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a good dude. But the authorities never stopped looking for Farley because, as they say, justice is patient. The case was handed off from one U.S. Marshal to another over the years before landing on Zach Thompson's desk in 2017. Zach was a newbie, and Lincoln, Nebraska was actually his first duty station as a marshal.
They come in fresh and new, and they want to do something. Yeah. And they spend all their time obsessing over it, you know?
Yeah.
Would you know, like, that's, I mean, fuck yeah, if you can get some evidence and, like, do some actual police work, fucking do it, dude.
And that's exactly what Thompson said. He believed that the case just needed a fresh set of eyes and someone new to look at it.
Yeah.
So he requested an age progression sketch of Farley's old driver's license and actually began looking through law enforcement files for overlooked connections.
That's so smart.
Eventually, he found a man named Richard Hanika, who was a friend of Farley's family, and his brother actually worked with Farley in Alaska. During an interview, Richard mentioned that Roger, his brother, had moved to St. Augustine, Florida in the early 1990s and started managing a bar there. Knowing that Farley and Roger were close, the investigators decided to follow up, but unfortunately, those leads turned out to be fruitless.
Okay.
More time passed, and they kept hearing of Farley being in Florida, so they began to understand that that's likely where he was.
Mm-hmm.
But many of the marshals began to question why the warrant for Farley was even open, as there's typically a 10-year window before prosecutors consider dismissing charges. Investigators later recalled Gillian. Investigators later recalled Gillian stating, "I'm going to prosecute the son of a bitch if we ever catch him." But in 2014, all the charges against Farley were dropped as the evidence was simply too old.
You know how fucking mad I would be if I was the low man on the totem pole and I had been arrested and then they were just like, "Oh, it's been 10 years. Like, I'm not even going to look for this kingpin anymore." I would be so fucking mad.
Yeah, I would too. The investigators also worried that even if Farley was caught, the U.S. Attorney's Office likely would decline to prosecute him, given that many of the marshals who worked on the case in 1985, like, were no longer active and the evidence was just so old at that point.
You can call them to the stand even if they're retired, though.
I think you have to question the validity of their witness testimony after 29 years.
But shouldn't it have been documented?
Yeah, but I mean,
It shouldn't just sit in their memory.
yeah, but even then, it's been 29 years, so things have become digitized. And God, since the 80s, like you hear cases over and over where evidence was just lost.
Yeah, see, that's bad police work.
Yeah. So after 29 years on the run, Farley was no longer considered a fugitive.
Oh,
But
cool.
in February 2020, a special agent named Kevin Grant was in his home office at the Miami Division of the Diplomatic Security Service.
Yeah,
What's
dude was
that?
bored as shit during COVID.
That is called the arm of the State Department that handles passport fraud. So Kevin
Okay.
Grant, serious, oh, such a serious role. But anyway, Kevin Grant was obviously a little bit alarmed when Tim Brown's name popped up on his computer.
Okay.
It had been flagged as potential fraud, as they had found an obituary for Timothy Terry Brown and confirmed with Florida that that death certificate did exist. So they knew that Tim Brown's identity had been stolen. Kevin Grant's job was to figure out who was using that.
Okay.
So Grant tracked the tail number on the plane registered to Tim Brown and unsuccessfully
Oof.
fingerprinted a rental car after he returned it. He got authorization to intercept Brown's mail, however, he couldn't open it. He even located the real Tim Brown's burial site in Lake Worth. However, they still couldn't pin the guy using Tim Brown to anyone else. And they truly believed that the only way to identify him was to get their hands on him.
Okay.
So on December 2nd, 2020, just as described before, a convoy of law enforcement vehicles rode quietly through the gate of Love's Landing and arrested Tim Brown, the man also known as Farley. 8 days after his arrest, Farley appeared in federal court for the first time at a hearing to decide whether he'd be released on bond. He could no longer be tried for any of his alleged offenses in Nebraska, but that didn't mean he couldn't be tried with fraud and identity theft for using the name Tim Brown.
I'm sorry. Let me just go on a little rant here. We're gonna, and I understand that he's like a kingpin. We're gonna charge him for identity theft, for stealing a 3-month-old baby's identity. And he hasn't done anything to financially ruin the identity that he's stolen, but everyone else that gets their identity stolen and is in financial ruin cannot get out of that, which is just like, it's too hard to prosecute.
Yeah, they can prosecute it when they
No,
want.
you just don't have a personal interest in the case,
Yeah.
is the difference.
So again, many people in Love's Landing had been confused about what happened in their community. But soon, everyone in the quiet, conservative area knew the truth. Their neighbor had been living a double life. And despite Farley's strong ties to the community, and the fact that law enforcement was in possession of his only, albeit fraudulent, passport, he was denied bond. While he sat in Marion County Jail, Farley's emotions ping-ponged between fear and relief. He later recalled that until his arrest, he wasn't even aware that the Nebraska case had been closed, stating, quote, "Every year I would think about contacting an attorney to check what my status was. But I was having such a good life that I kept putting it off." On July 15th, 2021, Farley arrived to a mostly full courtroom. By then, he'd been in jail for more than 7 months, and he was using a cane and suffering from a lingering cough after contracting COVID.
Dang.
Farley's lawyers argued that he was a far cry from one of the most infamous cocaine cowboys of Nebraska. The original Operation Southern Line indictment documented only a few ounces of cocaine ever being trafficked, and his alleged criminality was far in his past. albeit he committed crimes related to stealing people's identity, but those were the only crimes he committed, and he'd built long-lasting relationships within his community. One of the lawyers told the courtroom, quote, "Redemption is a path, and what I would say to this court is Mr. Farley's life has been defined not only by his criminal conduct, but by a series of actions that he has done for others. He is a radically different man."
That's fair.
The following week, on August 6, 2021, Farley was sentenced to 4 years in federal prison. He later recalled, quote, "I look at this as another life experience never to be repeated. I have spent the last 35 years trying to be the best person I can be and have no grudges against anyone." All he cares about was getting back to his, quote, "loving wife, good friends, and great neighbors."
Aww.
And Farley's neighbors said that they look forward to welcoming him back. No one that was interviewed in the sources believed that he belonged in prison. A Love's Landing resident, Kathleen Safford, stated, "I think what matters most in life is being kind and caring towards other people and not some sort of details of whatever someone did 30 years ago. He's obviously not a career criminal in any way. I'm sure when he gets back, we'll have some stories to listen to."
That's so nice.
I know. And that is the story of Howard Farley Jr., a man also known as Tim Brown, the alleged leader of one of the largest drug trafficking rings in Nebraska history.
That was cool. I like that one.
Me too. I thought that was really fun.
I'm not even really mad at this guy. Like, he seems like a really nice guy.
Right? I know. That was the hard part, is because I'm like, okay, you did a bunch of illegal shit. You trafficked drugs, but also you do have to take into the, like, you do have to account for who he is now. And that's what I hope our justice system would be.
Yeah, and they also, like, dropped the charges against, like, the whole cartel thing. Like, they weren't even, he can go back to being Howard.
Yeah.
Farley when he gets out of prison. The only thing that he's serving time for is the identity theft, which hurt literally nobody.
Yeah, it's kind of messed up, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, I get it. It's illegal.
I get it, but it just is like, really?
Yeah, maybe this is just one of the things that you just let go.
Yeah. Yep. But that's our case for this week. Yay!
That was great. I liked it.
Yeah, nice little palate cleanser. But don't worry, we have another terrible story in store for you in 2 weeks.
That sounds so horrible. Thank you.
So we'll talk to you then. Bye.
Bye.